jagged teeth pointing out. The guard at the gate shifted. She thought she saw him close his eyes as he sighed and settled into a more comfortable position. Swiftly, her tattered shoes silent over the ground, Kestrel sped toward him. She swung her fist with the key at his head. He lay in a heap at her feet, his temple bleeding. Kestrel fumbled with the key, her breath loud, gasping. It wasn't until she moved to set the key into the gate that she thought of the possibility that it was the wrong key, that she had been tricked, or Varric's had, or the senator. Horror spiked through her. But the key went in smoothly, and it turned, making no more sound than a knife in butter. A giddy rush, her heart soaring in her chest, her ribs spread wide with relief, a laughing breath. She pushed the gate open. She slipped out onto the tundra, stealthy at first, then running as fast as a deer. She was free. Her foot plunged into a puddle. The ground was soggy, the vegetation short and shrubby. Little cover, nowhere to hide. She was too exposed. Her breath rasped, her heart faltered. Her legs were hot and thick and slow. Then, horses. A sob of fear burst past her lips. She heard them behind her, fanned out wide, galloping. A hunt. A shout. She'd been seen. Little rabbit, little fox. Run! She fled. She couldn't really see where she was going, couldn't look back. Gasps tore at her throat. She stumbled, nearly fell, forced herself forward. She heard the horses stop, and that was worse, because the guards must be dismounting now. They were close, and she didn't want to know this. It could not be over. But someone caught her from behind, pitched her down. She screamed against the wet earth. She was dragged back inside the prison gate. She refused to walk. They pulled her through the mud, and then finally carried her. As on her first day in the camp, she was brought before the silver-braided woman. A thin purple welt cut across the woman's throat. Kestrel should have killed her. She should have locked all the women prisoners in their cells. Her escape had been too quickly discovered. She hadn't had enough of a head start. Yet another mistake.
"I told you that if you behaved, no one would hurt you," the woman said.
She unhooked the whip from her belt.
"No," Kestrel shrank. "Please, I won't do it again."
"I know you won't."
The woman shook the looped whip. It snapped out, loose at her thigh.
"That makes no sense,"
Kestrel's voice got threaded and high.
"I won't be able to work if you do that."
"Not at first, but afterward I think you'll work much better."
"No, please. Why punish me if I won't remember it?" "I won't. I'll be just like the other prisoners. I'll forget it. I'll forget everything."
"You'll remember long enough."
Kestrel twisted wildly, but hands were already opening the back of her dress. She was being turned around, pushed up against the gate, tied to the bars. The wind whispered across her bare back.
"I have been whipped before," she heard the memory of Arryn's voice. "Did you think I couldn't bear the punishment for being caught?"
Kestrel strained against her bonds, terrified.
"Princess," said the guard behind her.
Kestrel's muscles went tight. Her shoulders hunched. She couldn't breathe.
"Every new prisoner shines with a little light," the guard said. "Your light happens to shine brighter. It's best for everyone if it goes out."
Kestrel pressed her forehead against the bars. She stared at the tundra. Her breath was coming again now, hard and fast. There was a sharp whistling sound, like a bird taking off. The whip came down. It carved into her. Something wet ran down her ribs. She wasn't brave. She could hear herself as it continued. She wasn't anything she recognized. It used to be that Kestrel would treasure the memory of Arryn singing to her. She'd worry that she'd somehow forget it. The sliding low notes, the sweet intervals, or the way he'd sustain a long line, and how she loved the sound of him taking a breath, as much as she did the way he could hold a musical phrase aloft until it ended exactly where it should. But after the guards untied her from the gate,
when her back was on fire and she couldn't walk and her bones were a trembling liquid, she looked at the cup in the woman's hand. Kestrel reached for it. She begged to drink. The cup was set to her lips. She caught the silvery scent of the nighttime drug. The thought of becoming just like the other prisoners no longer seemed so bad. It would be a blessing to forget. After all, what was there to remember? Someone she never could have had. Friends dead or gone. A father who did not love her. The cup tipped. Water ran over her tongue, cool and delicious. She forgot the pain, forgot where she was, forgot who she'd been, forgot that she had ever been afraid of forgetting. 3. Aran added the captured Valorian vessels to his fleet. Some of the Dacran sailors who had been sent to scour the aqueducts found the source of the poison that had been flowing into the city's water supply. It was a large vat, lodged in a mountain tunnel that connected the water's path to arcades that came down the mountainside in a series of tiered arches. The vat was cleverly designed. It leaked a thick, brownish liquid in a dose measured by internal weights and counterweights. When Aran saw it, brought forth from one of the old mountain trenches that had been used 10 years ago by Harani slaves to construct the tunnel, he had wanted to pitch the vat off the cliff and watch it shatter on the rocks below. Instead, he helped carry it carefully down the mountain and stored it in the city's arsenal to be used against the Valorians in case of a siege. Everyone in the city drank rainwater collected in barrels or brought in from the countryside. They all went a little thirsty until Aran, having waited a few days for the aqueduct to flush itself clean, drank some of its water and felt no different than he had before. "Do you really think it could work?" Sarsin asked. Aran's cousin lay in her bed in his family home, still pallid. Her movements were slow, and she slept most of the day, but her eyes had grown brighter in the past few days. "It does work." Aran described the different parts of the miniature cannon he had designed in the Dacran Castle Forge. "It's what made the Eastern Queen agree to ally with us," he added, though with an uncomfortable sense that this perhaps had not been the whole explanation for the Queen's decision. "This weapon might give us the edge we need against the Empire, but we must make more. Sarsin, I need you." He brushed lank hair from her forehead and looked into the face that reminded him of his father, for whom she'd been named, an unfashionable, solid-sounding name she'd hated as a girl. He cupped her cheek. "I can't do this alone." She reached for his hand and held it. She no longer looked so weak. Sarsin smiled. "You're not alone," she told him. Eastern reinforcements came by ship roughly a week after the sea battle, and Aran was hugely relieved to see the new sloops drop anchor in his harbor. The Valorian counterattack would come soon, possibly somewhere along the western coast, he suspected. One of the new arrivals in the harbor created quite a commotion. A cage was lowered from the largest sloop into a launch and rowed slowly to the piers. As the launch approached, Aran saw that the Dacrans at the oars were stiff and silent, edged as far away as possible from the cage. One figure, though, leaned against the bars, crooning to the pacing animal inside. Aran immediately recognized the young man. He felt a surge of gladness. He hadn't expected Rashar to come. The Eastern Prince looked up to see Aran standing on the pier. A grin split his face. Aran used to think that Rashar had a skull's face. The nose and ears had been cut off. But Rashar looked so ferociously alive, his black eyes shining and lined with green paint, his teeth white and even, that although Aran remembered what he'd thought when he'd had his first shocking glimpse of Rashar's mutilations, that memory felt distant now. Rashar, ignoring the startled cries of his crewmen, leaped from the launch onto the pier. The launch rocked in the water. The small tiger growled. Arms folded across his chest, Aran walked to the end of the pier.
"Did you have to bring the tiger?"
"I kept him hungry during the journey here, just for you," Rashar said. "Go give him a nice snuggle, won't you? He's come all this way to see you. The least you could do is give him one of your arms to eat."
"Too much?
What about a hand? At least some fingers." Aaron, where's your hospitality?
Aaron, laughing, embraced his friend. He choked on his first lungful of smoke.
This is vile.
I told you you'd like it.
Roshar bit the stem of his pipe, lighting the tobacco. He shook the match out. For a few moments, he smoked in silent contentment. Both the silence and the contentment were, in Aaron's experience, rare for the prince.
Try it again, Roshar said, or I'll think you're rude.
Aaron, ignoring him, went to open a window. Sweet, warm air washed into his father's study.
Aaron, Roshar complained, shut the window. I'm cold. Why is your country so damned cold?
It's summer.
The first day of the season, which Valorians celebrated as first summer, had already passed. Roshar shuddered.
I want to go home.
What are you doing here?
Admit it, you missed me.
Aaron looked at him. Softly, he said.
I did.
The prince squinted at him through a cloud of smoke.
You seem better.
Aaron frowned, leaning against the casement.
I wasn't aware that I seemed all that bad.
Roshar snorted.
As one of Dakra's royal line and educated in the finest points of grace and discretion, I shall pass over any description of exactly how you were when you set your no-good illegal foot in my city.
Roshar eyed him closely, then his gaze wandered to the sword that Aaron had unbuckled and slung by its belt over the back of a chair when they'd entered the study.
What happened to your dagger?
Gone.
Aaron had dropped Kestrel's dagger into the sea. Roshar toyed with his pipe.
As for why I'm here, the queen thought that you could use someone with authority.
I've been managing fine.
So I understand. Zesh is impressed. Also, he hates you. But your delightful little power struggle is moot now that I'm here and outrank you both, don't I?
Slowly, Aaron said.
Of course.
Roshar smiled.
The queen sends her greetings.
Aaron was silent.
Hoping for something a little more friendly.
Well.
Roshar's voice went sly.
You know how she is, don't you?
Aaron flushed.
I think we should discuss possible scenarios for a Valorian attack.
Boring.
We don't have time for...
Oh, the Valorians are battering down the door right now. We have to do something.
You can go home now.
Roshar settled comfortably into his chair.
Speaking of Valorians, I hear that Lady Kestrel and Prince Varix married in secret. Yes, word has it that they were so consumed with passionate love that they disappointed hundreds of wedding guests with a private ceremony right after the lady's birthday at the end of spring. The Emrys couple simply couldn't wait.
Aaron doubted that passionate love had much to do with it. He shook his head.
She wants the Empire. She gets what she wants.
They're on a lover's holiday in the Southern Isles.
Aaron shrugged. His shoulders felt tight. Roshar didn't appear to notice.
You are better, said the prince.
Can we talk about the war now?
Whatever you want, little Harani.
Aaron unrolled a map and spread it across his father's desk. They studied the western coastline, the cliffs and rocky shores that would offer the Valorians an opportunity for a surprise attack, and the beach known as Larolin that led to flat land running right into the southern Harani estates. When daylight had darkened and Roshar's eyes grew slowly heavier, Aaron realized that the prince's gleeful needling had hidden a genuine fatigue from his journey. Aaron told him he should rest.
Choose whatever sweet suits you best, Aaron said. But please keep that tiger in his cage.
Aaron's a kitten, Roshar protested.
Purely for the purpose of annoying Aaron, it seemed, Roshar had named the tiger after him.
He's sweet-tempered and polite and very good-looking. Unlike some people I could mention.
You're wrong, Roshar said.
They were leaning over a map in Aaron's library. Aaron kept his fingers stubbornly pressed down on the cliffs along his country's western shore.
Wrong, Roshar insisted.
Aaron shook his head.
You're underestimating the Valorian general.
He's not going to send soldiers up cliffs. He doesn't need to. He's got the numbers. He can land his ships on that beach and take the countryside with sheer force. He doesn't have to be clever.
Aaron remembered Kestrel. I think he enjoys being clever. I think he might be undercut by his own cunning, if we can catch him at it.
Those cliffs are monstrously high.
His rangers are capable of it. If they scale the cliffs and come south while we're dealing with the Valorians that have landed on the beach, they'll flank us and squeeze us between them.
Rashara made a dismissive noise. Frustrated, Aaron said,
Are you so proud that you think no one can outmaneuver you?
Are you so ready to make the general into some almighty being, capable of anything just because he had your family slaughtered?
Anger knocked the wind out of Aaron. There was a hard silence. Rashara rubbed his eyes, smearing the green paint that lined them. He sighed.
I didn't mean...
Aaron. It was Sarsine. She was standing in the library doorway.
Not now, he told her.
Someone's here to see you.
Not now.
He says it's important.
What is important?
His message.
Which is?
He won't tell me. He wants to tell you himself.
I'm busy.
No, no, said Roshar. Go ahead, talk to him. We're done anyway. I'll inform the battalion leaders of my battle plan and...
Wait, Sarsine, who is this person?
A Harani groom who took care of horses at a way station in Valoria, along the road that goes north to the tundra.
Does his message have anything to do with a Valorian military operation?
I asked him. He says no.
Does he have information on the general, his troops, or the emperor?
No, nothing like that. But... Aaron turned away.
Later.
She took a breath as if to argue, then seemed to change her mind. I'll put him in your old rooms. He's traveled far to see you.
Well,
Roshar said cheerfully, rolling up the map he and Aaron had argued over.
Everything's settled, then. What's that beach called? Lerilin. We'll set out for it tomorrow, at dawn.
Aaron couldn't sleep. He threw his windows open. He heard an owl hunting in the summer dark. It was, of course, safer to send the majority of the eastern forces to the beach at Lerilin, with no soldiers held back to guard the cliffs. The beach was an ideal place for the Valorian army to land. The beach and its surrounding terrain were relatively flat and wide open, good for an invasion. The Dacrans, who didn't know the land they were defending, wouldn't have any height on the Valorians, and that would make repelling the invaders harder, which General Trajan would like. Rashar was probably right. Probably. Aaron had no power to overrule him anyway. Few of his people were in any condition to fight. He had no troops to command. He was lucky to have the Eastern Queen's help. Yes, lucky. The Queen, however, was no fool. She must have heard of Zash's resentment at being ignored by Aaron in the planning of a key battle. Aaron was glad Rashar was here, but it was nonetheless clear that he had been sent to put Aaron in his place. Aaron braced an arm against the casement, resting his forehead against his wrist. The night curled around him. He'd lit no lamp. He wondered if one of the reasons Valorians trained to get by on little sleep was so that they could feel the way he did right now, like there was no difference between him and the darkness. He heard the sough of trees. He thought of the general landing on Haran's shore. The muscles in his arm hardened. He'd never sleep now. He kept seeing the cliffs. They rose white and sparkling in his mind. Kestrel wouldn't be able to resist those cliffs. If she were mustering an invasion, she'd like the looks of the beach at Lerilin, but she'd love the cliffs. The cunning of it would be its own attraction. And the results? If even a small force got up those cliffs and came south to meet the Valorians already massed on the beach, Haran's defenses would be easily broken. The Valorians would take the countryside and work their way to the city, whose bay was now too well defended to take by sea. If Kestrel were the general, that's what she'd do. If Aaron were Kestrel, that's what he'd do. Aaron found that his loose hand had become a fist. He remembered the golden, oiled line that had marked Kestrel's brow as the sign of an engaged woman, and how much he'd hated it. One evening in the palace, Arryn had slowly nudged Kestrel up against the wintered windows of a closed balcony door. He'd felt her slender length against him. He'd kissed her mark. Later, he tasted the cosmetic oil on his lips. It had been bitter. He touched his tongue to it again. Arryn had had to struggle so hard for clarity. The things he had believed. He thought about the night the spell had finally broken. He'd sailed from the east. He'd risked everything to creep into the palace. He saw her again, the dismay on her face, the cold irritation, the way she'd rubbed her hands against the skirts of her blue silk dress, the sleeves belled and fastened tight at the wrist. That deep blue poured around her as she'd sat at the piano and tried to ignore him and played a laughing little melody. When he refused to leave, she'd turned cruel. It wasn't entirely true that Arryn felt nothing when he thought of Kestrel. He felt shame. He shuddered to think of his god's forsaken questions. He couldn't believe he'd asked them.
What did you do for that treaty? It gave me my country's freedom. It saved my life. What did you do to make the Emperor sign it? Are you marrying the prince because of me? Was it part of some kind of deal you made with the Emperor?
He still heard her cutting replies. He thanked the god of chance he'd stopped short of asking whether she was Tensen's moth. Yet another of the fantasies he'd entertained about her, in his compulsion to transform her into the person he longed for her to be. This, despite Tensen's loyalty to him, his honesty. Tensen had already told him the identity of his anonymous spy, Risha, the Eastern Princess, held hostage in the Imperial Court. Arryn straightened. His shoulders ached. He'd been standing in one position for too long. He sat on the wide windowsill, spine against the frame. He was aware of feeling both inside and outside. He let himself enjoy the balance of it. It cleared his head. What happened with Kestrel hadn't been for nothing. He'd gotten a feel for the way her mind worked. He'd caught her weakness for a sly move. He'd seen just how much she was her father's daughter. Arryn wondered how many people he'd need to handle Valorian rangers coming up the western cliffs. He wondered if he, too, was tempted by cunning. Maybe he was drawn as well to the biggest gamble. The first morning bird sang. The Harani god of games had once been mortal. Arryn knew the tale. She'd gambled her way into immortality, then wreaked merry havoc. The gods were not pleased. They began to lose treasured possessions. A pair of gloves that let the wearer touch colors and sounds. A ring that contained a whole other world within its circle. The god of night's favorite cat. When she won the sun, everyone lost their patience. The god of war was sent to deal with her. But nothing is ever simple between the gods, and the stories of the gods of war and games were many, and took certain sensual twists and turns that Arryn hadn't been allowed to hear as a child. Arryn shut the window. He took his sword, which had been his father's, and forged with beautifully tempered steel. For almost 10 years after the invasion, the sword had hung on a wall in this house, like a corpse on display. It felt good against his palm, and for a moment, it felt as if he weren't holding the sword, but his father's hand. Then the hilt became steel again. He made his way, quickly, it was almost dawn, to his stables. He saddled Javelin, Kestrel's horse, Arryn's now. The animal was strong and smart and fast. Arryn rode the stallion out into the gray morning. He thought that a commander of any army had better pray to both the gods of war and games. No battle is won without a good gamble. As the ground sped beneath Javelin's hooves, Arryn had a fleeting thought of the messenger who'd come to see him.
Later, he decided, and spurred his horse.
4. Arryn slunk forward on his belly and inched over the patchy grass. The wind shrilled in his ears. It whipped dirt into his eyes. He blinked it away, eyes streaming, and crept to the edge of the cliff. He heard soil crumble beneath his weight. It sifted down the cliffs. Arryn's pulse thumped hard. He imagined the lip of the cliff giving way. He'd plummet fast. Quickly, As he'd already done several times that day, Arryn dug his elbows into the earth and pulled himself just far enough to look down the cliff. The sea was dizzyingly far below. It foamed white against the rocks. There were no ships, no Valorians climbing up the cliffs, nothing. Arryn pushed himself away from the edge, rolled onto his back, looked up at the pale sky, and then at the waiting Harani. He met their eyes. He shook his head. Arryn had ridden to Eitria, a country estate he'd helped liberate during the First Winter Rebellion. The people there were too far from the city and mountains to rely on aqueducts for water. They had wells. They were healthy. Maybe they weren't born fighters, but Arryn would take what he could get. He'd ridden through the village and begged for help. About 20 men and women followed him to the cliffs. The bare cliffs. The quiet ones. Arryn looked out again over the empty water and imagined what Roshar must have thought as he'd looked for Arryn in the morning light and made his way to the beach without him. Arryn wondered if his disobedience, or would Roshar see it as cowardice, had cost him the alliance he'd worked so hard to forge. But on the second day, Arryn saw them. At first, he wasn't sure it was really happening. He hadn't seen the arrival of any ships. They must have dropped anchor out of sight, behind the southern edge of the cliffs that bulged out into the water at their base. Arryn hadn't seen the small launches row up to the foot of the cliffs. He only realized what they were. They looked like dark rocks below in the sea, when he saw tiny black figures against the shining white rock. Arryn peered again through his spyglass. The sun beat against his shoulders. He tasted sweat. His stomach tightened against the stiff grass beneath him. Valorian rangers were climbing up the cliffs in pairs. One held the rope at the bottom. The other, tied to the rope, moved up, setting pitons and strange pieces of gear into the rocks. The climbers clipped the rope to the gear. Each looked somewhat like a horse's stirrup, so that the rope passed through freely. Then the climbers scaled the cliff as their partners below fed out slack on the ropes. There weren't many, 100 by Arryn's count. He watched the climbers reach the end of their ropes. They used their gear to anchor themselves to the cliff wall. Then they pulled up the rope, taking in the slack as their partners below began to climb the same path. When they met at the anchor, they repeated the whole process of climbing up as far as the rope's length would let them. For a moment, Arryn let himself imagine how they must feel. The wind screaming, their skin dusted, lips chapped, their fingers trembling over the rock until they found a hold. Relief when the grip was good. A jolt of fear when their toes slipped on glassy rock. Their feet cut away. They hung, arms blazing in pain. The rope held. Their feet found purchase and dug into the cliff. Hands bloody, mouths dry. They kept climbing. Arryn pushed back from the cliff. He stopped thinking about what the rangers felt. They had come to steal his country and kill his people. He didn't need his god to tell him what to do. He had his small group of armed Harani fall back and crouch behind nearby bushes that were stunted and twisted by high winds. Arryn waited until the first set of climbers had hauled themselves up over the cliff's lip. They staked themselves to the ground, then began pulling up the rope as their partners below made the final ascent. Once the rangers were nailed to the ground and their hands were full, the Harani emerged from the bushes. Arryn was the first to fall upon them, to show the other Harani what to do. A ranger turned, brown eyes wide. He was still staked to the ground. Arryn's sword sliced the long gathered rope in the Valorian's hands. It zipped away, spun down over the cliff. A scream floated up from below. Arryn cut the ranger's anchor and set the point of his sword to the ranger's sweat-shiny throat. "The blade or the rocks below?" Arryn asked in Valorian. The words sounded airless, scratched raw by the wind. The whites of the Valorian's eyes showed clear around. After one loud heartbeat, Arryn realized the ranger was too afraid to answer. Arryn made the choice for him and stabbed.
"I'm not talking with you," Roshar declared, as he dropped the flap of the tent's opening in Arryn's face.
Arryn pushed through anyway.
"You're bleeding on my floor," the prince said. "That stain will be impossible to get out."
Arryn glanced down. The tent's floor was sand. Blood was trickling from his side, darkening the sand in coin-sized drops. A Valorian dagger had worked its way past Arryn's hardened leather armor, got in right at the ribs where the armor buckled. It had happened on the beach, after Arryn had dealt with the rangers and rode to meet the Eastern Army.
"You were at the Beck, I suppose," Roshar said. "Away from all the fun. That's what you get for being late."
Roshar pulled his sweat-drenched tunic away from his skin.
"Fugh, I stink. Roshar, will you shut up? I said I'm not talking with you. You can't do anything right, can you?" "But the general?" "Yes, retreated. Yes, without his precious rangers. I heard what you did. Tossed them from the cliff, eh? Very sporting of you. But you were late to my battle when I needed you, and I told you, and whose land is this anyway that I just fought to keep?" "I know. I'm sorry,"
the prince snorted. Arryn, unsure what to say, fumbled with his armor buckles. The cut along his ribs stung.
"I see that no one's helped you out of your armor yet. Poor baby. Now, me."
Roshar gestured at himself, dressed only in tunic and trousers, arms bare and muscular, and smeared with someone else's blood.
"I got out of armor as soon as the Valorians cast off from the beach, because I am a prince, and I told someone to take it off me, and people do as I say,"
Arryn said.
"That's what you want from me?"
Roshar lowered his arms.
"Do you really want me to do everything you say?"
No answer.
"Doesn't it matter that I was right about the cliffs?"
Roshar winced.
"Honestly, that makes it worse. I'm not going to obey you. You're my friend, not my master."
Roshar looked away, his mutilated nose blunting his profile. He studied the tense, blank canvas wall, which glowed in the sun. Roshar sighed, tugging on one cropped ear. Then he turned back and faced Arryn squarely. His mouth was a long, tired line.
"Here."
He jerked at Arryn's armor and began unbuckling it.
"Stop bleeding. Oh, just look at you. Arryn, you're a mess." "I didn't need you anyway," Roshar told him as they rode back to the city, having left behind several battalions to keep the beach secure. "I happen to be very good at war. It's because I'm so handsome, like one of your gods. People see me and their minds go blank. I run my sword right through them."
Arryn chicked at Javelin, urging him ahead of Roshar's horse. Roshar caught up. Like most Easterners, he rode without reins, guiding his horse solely through knees, heels, and the shifting of his weight. This left him free to gesture expansively as he talked.
"Are you listening?"
He leaned to poke Arryn in the shoulder.
"I'm not sure you appreciate the magnitude of having a god in your midst." "Can I pray for you to go away?"
Roshar grinned.
"We took a few Valorians prisoner."
"Why?"
"For information, obviously. Not much has come out of Valoria lately. Our spies have been quiet. Yours?"
Arryn hadn't heard anything from Tenson or his moth. He shook his head.
"Well,"
Roshar rubbed his palms together.
"Let's see what a little questioning reveals. I'm sure the prisoners will be happy to talk."
Arryn shot him a sidelong look.
"Arryn, you injure me. Torture is the furthest thing from my mind, I assure you. People love talking to me. I promise I'll ask my questions very, very nicely."
Arryn held his breath underwater until his lungs ached, then broke the surface of the bath. His bathing room echoed with the sound of splashed water. Dirty lather lapped around his knees. He touched his side, and his fingers came away pink. The cut along his ribs was bleeding again. It was too shallow to stitch. He found himself wondering how many scars the general had. Arryn's lungs burned, as if he was still holding his breath, which made him realize that he was, and that it hurt to feel such hatred and know that no scar could be enough, that the general could suffer no pain that would ever make Arryn feel better. The general and his daughter didn't look alike. Arryn remembered how he'd hated to notice this during his first months as Kestrel's slave. He'd wanted to see the traces of that man in her, and it had unnerved him that he couldn't. There was something similar about the eyes, but hers were a much paler brown. Arryn wasn't even sure he could call them brown. Honey wasn't brown. And the shape, different, too, slightly tipped up at the corners. Arryn remembered making such comparisons, and how his desire to see something in her that he could hate shifted into self-disgust at far too much attention paid. Then, slowly, a curiosity to find her so different. And then came another emotion, one both softer and harder. Arryn got out of the bath. He got dressed and got out of his rooms. Sarsine stopped him on the stairway that ran down from the west wing. He smiled.
You look better.
She crossed her arms. It's been a week. His brow crinkled.
Since what?
Since that messenger came.
Oh, I forgot.
You've been busy. Her tone was dangerously even.
I'll talk with him now.
You've been busy, she repeated, throwing people off cliffs.
That's an exaggeration.
So it's not true?
What do you want from me, Sarsine?
You blamed Kestrel for changing, but you've changed too. His voice was hard.
This is not the same.
Isn't it? He turned his back on her. He jogged down the stairs, the tempo of his boots beating fast and sure.
I tried to get here as soon as I could, said the messenger.
He was a short man, all knobby wrists and elbows and knees, an oddly tiny nose. There were bags under his eyes. The irises were greenish, which reminded Arryn of Tenson. They sat in the receiving room of Arryn's childhood suite. He didn't like being there. He looked at his childhood instruments, still hung on the wall. He remembered Kestrel touching them, her fingers plucking a string. He saw the birthmark on her right hand, in the middle of the soft web between forefinger and thumb. It had been like a little black star. Arryn should take those instruments down. He should get rid of them.
It happened about a month ago, the messenger said.
Arryn's attention snapped back to him.
Someone gave me something.
The man nodded his hands together.
She told me to give it to you, but I don't have it anymore.
What was it?
A masker moth.
What?
Arryn's voice was sharp.
One of those Valorian moths, the kind that change color. A prisoner gave it to me.
Arryn's heart picked up speed.
Who gave it to you? A Harani woman. That's not possible.
Tenson had told Arryn that the moth, his valued spy in the capital, was Risha. No one could mistake Risha for a Harani. Like all Easterners, her skin was brown, a much darker shade than even Arryn's, which was tanned from years in the sun.
I know what I saw, the messenger said. Tell me everything. I take care of horses along the road that runs north of the Valorian capital. A prison wagon stopped. They go by sometimes. I was watering the horses while the guards were stretching their legs. The woman called to me. She was reaching through the bars and asked me to give you the moth, but the guards saw. That's why I don't have the moth anymore. It got crushed. The guards were rough with me. Her, too.
What happened?
I don't know. I couldn't see. Anyway, they drove off.
That's it?
The man shifted uncomfortably at Arryn's tone.
Should I not have come?
No.
Yes.
Arryn briefly squeezed his eyes shut. His pulse was going too fast.
You were right to come. I'm sorry I lost the moth. I don't care about that. Just, she spoke to you in Harani?
Yes. You're sure?
The messenger gave him an odd look.
I can recognize my own language. She was mother-taught, like you and me.
I don't speak Harani, he remembered Risha saying. She'd also never said that she was a spy. Arryn had taken Tenson's word for it.
You said you couldn't see. What couldn't you see? I couldn't see into the wagon. Its walls were solid, the doors, too. I saw her at the window.
Describe her.
I can't.
Arryn tried very hard to speak evenly.
What do you mean, you can't? You saw her. You said so.
Well, yes, but...
The man was clearly frustrated, too.
I saw only her hand. What color was her skin? Like mine? Yours?
More or less. Less, I guess. Kind of pale. The color of a house slave's.
Not Dacron.
There must be something else you can tell me.
It felt increasingly difficult for Aaron to sit still.
What happened to the prisoner?
The man rubbed his weathered neck, avoiding Aaron's gaze.
The guards hit me. My head was ringing. I couldn't hear what they did inside the wagon. I don't know what they said, but her voice sounded horrible. And then, the wagon drove north, toward the tundra.
Dangerously, Rashara said,
"You believed my little sister was spying for Hiram, and you didn't see fit to mention it."
"I'm mentioning it now." "Arin, sometimes I really don't like you."
"It wasn't my secret to share." Tenson said that his informant insisted on keeping her identity anonymous. "I pressed him. He gave me a name. I admired her. Everyone in the city would be dead if she hadn't told Tenson about the poison in the aqueducts. If she wanted to be anonymous, I had to honor that."
"You had to honor saving your own skin, you mean? The Queen and I might have felt a little differently about you if we'd known you were using our sister for information she could have been killed for obtaining."
"It wasn't your sister."
"That's not the point."
"I know, but what would you have done in my place?"
Roshar stared moodily into the library fireplace. No fire had been lit there for months, but the smell of cinders remained. He played with his ring, a thick band that looked as though set with a dull black stone. It was unusual for an Easterner to wear a ring. They liked to keep their hands free of any ornamentation. This ring, Arin knew, had a particular purpose. What appeared to be a stone was, in fact, a vial that contained a numbing serum. He'd never asked, but he suspected that the serum could also kill. Roshar wiggled the ring.
"Arin," he said quietly, "you're really pushing things."
"I know," Arin said again. "I'm sorry."
"So, your moth is not my sister?"
"Yes."
"She's Harani?"
"Yes.
A dead Harani."
Aaron shook his head.
"She was sent to the Tundra's prison camp."
"As good as dead," Rashar amended.
"It's a work camp. You can't make a dead body work. This was only a month ago. She could be alive."
Rashar swiftly met Aaron's eyes.
"No. Oh, no. Don't even think what I think you're thinking. I could lead a small force north."
"Stop right there.
She could have valuable information."
"Not worth it. She doesn't deserve to be there."
"She knew what she was getting into. All our spies know the risk."
Gently, Rashar added,
"You can't save everyone."
Aaron let out a slow breath. He pressed palms to his eyes. His hands were cold. Kestrel's hands were always cold at first to the touch. He used to like to feel how they would slowly warm. Aaron pulled himself up short. He was suspicious of the way his mind worked, how it leaped for no reason to Kestrel, how this reminded him of so many times before, the way his thoughts would turn to her and bank home, like he was a hunting bird and she was the spinning lure.
"I'm not going to tell you what to do," Roshar said. "We've had enough of that. I'm simply going to ask you, you, who I will admit have some preternatural gift for strategy, if you think it's smart to send soldiers north, away from the war here, to attempt to rescue one woman from prison when you don't know how many lives this rescue would cost, or even the identity of the person you're looking for. Well, Arin, is it smart?"
"No."
"Are you going to do it anyway?"
"No," Arin said reluctantly. "I won't."
And he meant it. 5. Arin's hand twitched against the pillow. His legs twisted the sheets. He opened his eyes. The moon was large and yellow in the window. He wondered how the moon would look from the rooftop gardens. And he suddenly was in the gardens, both of them at the same time, even though the eastern garden and the western one were separated by a locked door. The smooth stones were cold under his bare feet. He was somewhere between sleeping and waking. Then he forgot this realization and was fully inside the dream without knowing that he was. He heard someone's footfalls on the other side of the garden wall. But he was on both sides, in both gardens, his and Kestrel's. He was alone. He was still. He was not making that sound. Again he heard the gravel scatter. But no one else was there. The night sky unfolded. Someone was snipping its threads. It came down on him in panels of silk. The blue of it covered his eyes, filled his mouth. His ribs spread wide. He was drowning. He was trying to drink the cloth. His throat yearned for it, even as his lungs collapsed. He startled awake. The sheets were damp. His breath came short. The dream deteriorated. He had only images of blue silk, on his eyes, in his mouth, too. He sat up straight. His bed was washed in moonlight. His mind flickered with a memory of the last time he'd seen Kestrel, the spill of her blue dress over the piano bench. He made himself go back to sleep. In the morning, he vaguely knew that he'd had a nightmare. Then he frowned, uncertain that nightmare was the right word. He tried to remember it. He had flashes, the sensation of drowning, the sense that he had wanted to drown. Something blue. Aaron suddenly remembered enough to wish that he hadn't. He shoved the dream from his mind. As is the way with fragile thoughts, the cobwebby threads spun away. They became nothing, or almost nothing. They became a feeling he could no longer explain as he cupped water from the basin to his mouth. The feeling drifted, not a thought or a memory anymore, just a flutter of unease. He went to Sarsine's room for breakfast. The suite had been hers as a girl, decorated according to the orders of Aaron's sister, whose own suite was closed off, curtains drawn. Sarsine set her cup in its saucer. "What's wrong?" "Nothing." He'd come to talk, but found that he didn't know what to say, and didn't really want to say anything after all. "You have shadows under your eyes. The god of sleep does not love you." Aaron shrugged. He peeled a summer fruit, the little knife moving quickly in his hand. The fruit's violet flesh dented and dripped. It smelled fragrant, dusky, sweet, familiar. A perfume. On the skin, right at the base of her throat. He dropped the fruit to his plate, no longer hungry. Sarsine took it from him and ate, sucking her thumb to get the juice. "Aren't you pleased that some of us are well enough to harvest fruit?" He focused his attention.
"Yes, but..."
"Not well enough to fight."
"I don't want you to fight."
"Not me, perhaps." She drank her tea.
"Could you oversee a project?"
She raised her black brows. He pulled folded pages from the inside pocket of his light jacket. They described in detail how he'd made the miniature cannon, the process for making the molds for the barrel and ball, the dimensions, the way to fit the barrel into a leather stock. Sarsine examined the pages.
"How many do you want?" "As many as you can have made."
He went quiet. She let him be. He ate a bit of bread, then caught himself staring at Tenson's ring on his smallest finger. He wondered why his spymaster had lied to him. Tenson had promised the moth her anonymity. That had been clear from the first. Then Tenson had seemed to backtrack on that promise, or to let it fall under the weight of his greater promise of loyalty to Aaron. Tenson had named Risha as his clever spy. Why would a Harani woman be so insistent on her anonymity? A servant, likely, in the Imperial Palace, scared to be discovered. The Emperor was a vengeful man. Aaron touched his scar. His fingers were sticky. Could the moth have been Delia? But the Harani dressmaker who had sewn Aaron's face had given him information directly. He didn't understand why she would do that and go through an elaborate charade of being Tenson's secret spy. As if guessing the course of his thoughts, Sarsine said, "What about the messenger?"
"I spoke with him. Told him he could go home."
"Aaron, the borders are closed. He trekked through the mountains from Valoria. You can't send him back. He has no home." Aaron winced.
"I wasn't thinking."
"That only happens to you when your heart gets in the way." He felt again that flutter of unease, He tried to remember the dream he had made himself forget. He stood, eager to get away from his cousin, who knew him too well, even though that was, he realized, why he had come.
"The messenger can stay in my old rooms, then,"
Sarsine said. "I'll let him know, if he hasn't already left." Rashar was in the kitchen yard with his tiger, who just killed a chicken. The flagstones were strewn with bloody feathers. The tiger, though still small, had large paws. It lay in the yard, panting in the sun, paws over its prize, muzzle pink and wet. The prince eyed Arryn.
"Was that a laying hen?" Arryn asked. "I have news for you. Not about chickens. The Valorian prisoners."
Rashar sat at the edge of the well, his expression hard to read. Arryn's heart dropped.
"What kind of news? Would you like the bad news first, or the news I'm not sure whether you would take as good or bad?" "Bad news. Your spymaster's dead. Tenson."
Arryn had expected this, yet the stab of sorrow went as deep as if he'd been wholly unprepared.
"The dressmaker, too. The general killed Tenson, or at least that's what they say. Unclear about the dressmaker."
Arryn's stomach was hollow. He remembered looking up at Delia through the veil of his own blood and thinking, for a moment, that she looked like his mother.
"Do you want the other news?" Rashar tentatively asked.
No. Arryn was suddenly sure that he did not want to hear it, would not be able to bear it. He felt a sinking dread. Rashar stumbled. A chicken feather lifted in a sudden breeze and eddied along the base of the well.
"Arryn, Kestrel's dead."
His ears were ringing. He felt as if he'd fallen into the well. He heard Rashar's voice from far away. The words tumbled down to him.
"It was recent," Rashar said. "A disease. While she was away from the capital, traveling with the prince. The whole empire is in mourning." "That's not true."
Rashar said something. Arryn couldn't hear him. He was at the bottom of the well. The water closed over his head, cold and black. 6.
"I'm fine."
"Arryn, I know you're not." Sarsine had been waiting for him by Javelin's empty stall when Arryn returned with a lathered horse. Arryn felt a jagged, sharp sort of feeling, rusted in parts, menacingly shiny in others. If it had been a real thing lying in the dirt, anyone would have known better than to touch it. He had gone for a ride. He'd left his house so there would be no question of visiting or avoiding parts of it that reminded him of her. He'd pushed Javelin hard. But when he had finally slowed the stallion and paced him under the green canopy of the city's horse paths, he'd wiped the sweat from his face and remembered whose horse was beneath him. He saw that he had no choices. He saw that even avoidance was a reminder. His hands held the reins too short. An emotion claimed him, merciless and familiar. His heart shrank. It felt small and hard and full, like a nut he could crack in his fist. His face was still wet. He'd ridden too far. He turned Javelin back home. When he saw Sarsine waiting in the open, shaded stables on a three-legged stool, he had ignored her and let Javelin drink from the trough in the yard. He had stripped the horse of his saddle, lifted off the reins, fetched a bucket of water, which he had slowly poured over the horse, who snorted and lowered his head. Arryn scraped water from the coat, then wiped him down with a cloth. He checked the hooves, digging out mud and pebbles with a pick, using his fingers to get gently into the grooves on either side of the hoof's frog. Finally, Arryn saw that his silence wouldn't be enough to make his cousin go away. He brought the horse into the stables. He said he was fine. She said he wasn't. He wiped down Javelin's tack and hung it up and tried silence again, this time because he was sure that if he spoke, he'd say something he'd regret. She said, "Why do you think it's wrong to mourn her?"
"Sarsine," his voice was tight, "if you love me, you'll leave."
"Answer me first." The words shot out of him.
"Because she wasn't who I thought she was. You can't mourn someone you didn't know."
I saw how you were with each other. Why would you think you didn't know her?
Because she's a liar. She has her games, her clever tricks. Everyone falls into her trap. I did, too.
He trailed off, listening to his own words. He began to brush Javelin's brown coat, leaning in hard.
She's not dead.
She's not? Sarsim sounded worried. He watched the horse's muscles twitch and leap under the brush.
No.
Aaron, I know how this feels. You know that I do. Like it's impossible. Like some mistake has been made, and if you could only correct it.
That's not it. I'm saying that the whole story sounds false.
I don't understand. The brush was moving rapidly.
The secret marriage to start with. The first summer wedding was valuable to the Emperor. All that goodwill. The excitement to witness the Emperor's dynasty growing. The bride. She was a prize. Do you know that? That wedding wasn't about the Emperor's son marrying Kestrel. It was about the Emperor marrying the military. The Emperor would never forego that wedding. If they married in secret, then why didn't the Emperor force them to marry again for everyone to see? It doesn't make sense.
You don't want it to make sense.
A disease killed her? I never saw her sick the entire time I worked in her villa. She was only bedridden once, and that's because...
Aaron stopped, remembering how she'd limped. She'd been injured in a duel that she had fought for him. He lowered the brush. He'd been here before. He used to do this all the time, invent stories about Kestrel that fit with her bandaged knee, the way she'd kissed him, the night she'd unlocked the door that separated her rooftop garden from his. From a window in his suite, he'd seen the door open. He had waited, pulse rising. Moments like that, right before she had shut the door again, haunted him in the capital, made him imagine things about her. Lovely, tempting scenarios. He remembered how he'd even wondered if she could be Tenson's moth.
First summer was about a month ago, he heard himself saying.
Javelin huffed and stamped. He curved his neck to waffle Aaron's chest. Sarsin started to speak.
Please leave, Aaron said. I answered your question. I want to be alone. I need to think, he added,
though he wasn't even sure what he was thinking. When she'd gone, Aaron threaded fingers through the horse's mane. Kestrel loved Javelin. She'd left him behind, anyway. Aaron remembered seeing her hand in Javelin's mane, curling into the coarse strands. This made him remember the almost freakish length between her littlest finger and thumb as her hand spanned piano keys, the black star of the birthmark. He saw her again in the Imperial Palace, her music room. He'd seen that room only once, about a month ago, right before first summer. Her blue sleeves were fastened at the wrist. Something tugged inside him, a flutter of unease. Do you sing? Those had been her first words to him the day she had bought him. A band of nausea circled Aaron's throat, just as it had when she'd asked him that question, in part for the same reason. She'd had no trace of an accent. She had spoken in perfect, natural, mother-taught Harani.
I told you everything I know, said the messenger.
Aaron had gone to his childhood suite, feeling an anxiety verging on panic at the thought of not finding the man there, of having to track him down, of time lost. But the man had opened the outermost door almost immediately after Aaron's pounding knock.
I didn't ask you the right questions, Aaron said. I want to start again. You said that the prisoner reached through the bars of the wagon to give you the moth.
Yes.
And you couldn't really see her.
That's right.
But you said she was Harani. Why would you say that if you couldn't see her?
Because she spoke in Harani.
Perfectly.
Yes.
No accent.
No.
Describe the hand.
I'm not sure.
Start with the skin. You said it was paler than yours, than mine.
Yes, like a house slave's.
Which wasn't very different from a Valorian's.
Could you see her wrist, her arm?
The wrist?
Yes, now that you mention it. She was in chains. I saw the manacle. Did you see the sleeve of a dress?
Maybe.
Blue?
Dread churned inside Aaron.
You think or you know?
I don't know. Things happened too fast.
Please, this is important. I don't want to say something I'm not sure is true.